Okay. The a few things converge this week in vis-a-vis the Sedra. It is the completion of the building of the Mishkan. It's also Parshas Parah. Speaks about the mitzvah Parah Aduma. And we're still in the week of Kisiso, where there was the sin of the golden calf. It's last Shabbos, but we're still on the border of last Shabbos to next Shabbos. All of those things are connected. It says that the Mishkan was in part a kapara for the sin of the golden calf, and the Parah Aduma also is a kapara for the sin of the golden calf. So insofar that it says if a child goes to a party and throws up, eats too much, throws up and messes up the whole place, so who do you call to clean it up? The mother. So the Cheta Egel, the Egel made a mess, and you call the mother. The Parah Aduma was like a golden mother, right? The gold is a reddish hue. You call the mother to clean up the mess. So all these things go together. Parah Aduma, Cheta Egel, and last week's Sedra, the Mishkan, and this week's Sedra all have a connection. So the question is, what exactly is the connection? So one way of understanding it, and also understanding the enigma of the Parah Aduma, insofar that it is Metahir Tmeim, somebody who is seriously Tamei, a tumor that comes from a corpse. He becomes Tahar through the Parah Aduma, and the people who are involved with the Parah Aduma become minimally Tamei. So how could the same thing be Metahir and Metamei? That's the enigma of the Parah Aduma, one of the enigmas. So one way of looking at it is the following. The Cheta Ego, which was a borderline idolatry, came from the fact that the Jewish people felt that they needed an intermediary between them and God. And that God is up there somewhere in the spiritual realm, and down here in the physical realm you need physical things to get involved, because God is too much in the spiritual to be involved with the physical world. That was the foundation mistake of idolatry, how it got started, right? People felt that, the Rambam says, that if God gave such power and honor to the heavenly bodies, right, and then we should honor them too, just like you honor a student as honor for the rab, or you honor the emissaries of the king as honor to the king. The mistake they made is that you don't honor the emissaries of the king in the king's presence, only when the king's not there. Right, ain cholkin kovad the Talmud b'makom harav. You give kovad to a student when the rav's not there as kovad for the rav. This is a student of that rav. But if the rav's there and you direct your attention to the student or to the emissary of the king when the king is there, that's an affront to the king. So what was their mistake? Their mistake was that the king's not there. That, as it says, the outlook of most of the nations of the world, Ramal Kol Goyim Hashem, God is up there somewhere, right? Too much, too big and too great to be involved in the petty affairs of this petty world, and therefore he gives over his the guidance and the control of the world to physical things, planets, stars, angels, whatever it may be, his son, his cousins, or whatever. That's right. You can't go to God directly. You have to go through intermediaries, emissaries. So since God is not there, so you honor the emissaries or whatever. That was their original mistake. They didn't serve these things. They just gave them honor for feeling that this is honor, not in the presence of the king. And I think that's what it says in the Aseres HaDibros, Lo yiyya lecho Elohim achirim al ponai. Rashi says, what's the al ponai? As long as I'm around. What does that mean, as long as I'm around? What it means is, if it would be that I would take a vacation, God said, I wouldn't be around, then there would be a place to honor other powers that I delegated power to. But since I'm always around, right, our philosophy is what it says in Hallel, right? Mi kashem elokeinu hamagbil ashavis. God is up there. But hamashbili liros b'shamayim v'aretz. He's as much involved in every physical thing in this world, right? It's because he's so great and up there, it doesn't take away from the fact that he's also involved in this world. And that's what Rabbi Yochanan said. If you say b'yitin lecho, motzi Shabbos, Rabbi Yochanan said, "Kol makom shatamotzei gvuraso or gedulaso shalakadosh baruch hu, shama tamotzei anvisanusa." Wherever the Torah speaks about the greatness of God, it immediately speaks about His humility. Right? God is hakel hagavol hagibor v'hanora, but He's also mishpat yosom v'almana. Why? Because you shouldn't make that mistake. If you get too carried away with God's greatness, you may think that He has nothing to do with this world. So it doesn't take away a bit from His greatness the fact that He's involved with the world. That is our hashkacha. In any case, so that was the foundation of idolatry, and that's what the Jews said. They thought that they didn't have a personal relationship with God. Moshe Rabbeinu was their emissary. He was the intermediary between them and God. And when Moshe Rabbeinu didn't come back when he said he would, and they thought that he no longer has any connection to this world either, so they need someone to take something to take the place. And they could have chosen another human being, but they said human beings are too vulnerable. Right? We lost one Moshe Rabbeinu, two Aaron or something like that. They're just as vulnerable. So let's get something more durable. So let's make another intermediary that will be the physical intermediary between us and God, because the physical and the spiritual really can't go together. We need something physical in this world that will take care of the physical world, because God is so spiritual, there's no connection to the physical world. That was the, according to many, the foundation of the sin of the golden calf. They wanted an intermediary between them and God, taking the place of Moshe Rabbeinu. They didn't think that this was a god. They just thought that this was an intermediary.
Why did they choose a calf?
Because that calf represented spiritual powers of sustenance. A cow represents a plowing and whatever, and they felt that in the desert they needed that power. Right, that power of sustenance, of giving them something to eat in the desert. So they felt that this is the intermediary that they have in the shape of that cow, whatever. In any case, so what was the crux of the sin? That the physical and spiritual world don't get together. Right? It's not that everything that's in the spiritual world has an intimate connection with the physical world, but physical and spiritual are separate. Okay. The Mishkan went against that completely. Because the Mishkan was a place where God's presence could dwell in this world. As the Zohar says, Hasidim like to quote, right? Ratzah Kodesh Baruch Hu Mother B'tachtonim, the Rabban Shem wanted a place to dwell in this physical world. So it's not that God is separate from the physical world, just the opposite. He comes kibiyachol and dwells in the physical world, right? In a physical plant, whatever that means. But it certainly goes against the idea of the physical and the spiritual being totally separate. It says, because of the cheto ego, before the sin of the golden calf, people would not have died. Chorus al haluchos, cherus mi malach hamavis. It would have reverted back to what it was before the sin of Adam and Chava. Right? The sin of Adam and Chava necessitated death. What's death? The separation between the physical and the spiritual part of parts of a person. The body is separated, goes through its atonement, decays, goes back to its elements. The neshama goes to its spiritual atonement in Gehenna, Gan Eden, and so on. And then they're put back together again by Tzchias HaMeisim. But had it not been for the sin of Adam and Chava, not that people would have lived forever in this world. That wasn't the purpose of creation. The purpose of creation was the world to come. They wouldn't have died. There wouldn't have been a necessity of separating the physical and the spiritual, but the body and the soul would have worked on each other, and the soul would have refined the body, and the body being more refined would have made the soul even bigger, and they would have worked together in a symbiotic relationship, and then the entire person, body and soul, would have graduated into the next world. That would have been instead of death. There wouldn't have been a necessity of separating the physical and the spiritual. They would have gone together to the next world. Because man sinned, it wasn't possible for this relationship to... The body could never refine the soul, where the soul then could refine the body to a point where they both would be able to ascend to the next world. Each one had to be dealt with separately, and there had to be an union of death. Had they not sinned by the golden calf, the giving of the Torah would have reverted things back to the original plan, where there wouldn't have been a Malach HaMavis, there wouldn't have been death, separation between the physical and the spiritual, because they sinned the way we explained it and couldn't understand the total integration of the physical and the spiritual, but they saw a separation, and therefore they still were on the level where they're going to need that separation in order to go to the next world. So that's why death was a result of the sin of the golden calf. And therefore, that which atones or purifies the result of death is the Parah Aduma, has a connection to the sin of the golden calf. What's the connection? The connection is like this. What's this idea of call the mother? Right? What was the sin of the golden calf? They thought that the physical and spiritual worlds are separate. Because of that, that brought death to the world where, in fact, the physical and spiritual are separated. But it's not really so. It looks like that. So when a person comes in contact with the dead, right, the Medrash says, Lo hames metame, it's not the dead body that makes you tame. And it's not the aether of the Parah Aduma that makes you tahar. This is the way that I set up the world, God said, and it's more of a metaphysical kind of thing than the physical thing itself. The way I understand that, there's many ways of understanding it, but the way I understand it is like this. When a person comes in contact with the dead, it affects his soul. Subconsciously, whatever, consciously, more subconsciously, right, more on a soul level, it gives the impression that the physical world and the spiritual world are separate. Because here you have a dead body without an neshama, right? So it's possible to have the physical without the spiritual, which reverts back to the sin of the golden calf, separation of physical and spiritual. And that makes a tremendous effect on a person's neshama. What is tumah? Tumah is where there was holiness and it left. And it left a vacuum. When a person comes in contact with the dead, it makes an impact on his soul that seems to say that spiritual and physical can exist separate, and it separates him from God because he's a person in the physical world and God is totally spiritual, and therefore he feels separate from God. A person, therefore, who is Tamei, right? Tamei Tumas Meis, what's the result? What can't he do? He can do everything. Unless he's a Kohen, he's not allowed to become Tameh. But a regular Jew can become Tameh. Go to a funeral, right? You can go and go to a cemetery if you want. The only result is you can't go into the Beis HaMikdash, and you can't eat karbanos. You can't eat sacrifices. Why? Because you're separate. You don't have that connection, right? You don't have that connection to God because you feel separated. Because you see that physical and spiritual can be separated. That's the impression that the dead body gives you. And once you have that separation between you and God, you can't go into the Beis HaMikdash as if everything is fine. There's a separation. So going into the Beis HaMikdash, eating karbanos, implies that there is no separation, and there is. So you have to somehow work out that separation. So like we said, the Mishkan was one way of showing that the physical and spiritual world are not separate. And they can exist simultaneously, together, integrated. That was what the Mishkan was. The Parah Aduma also represents that. When you come in contact with the dead, it affects, has an impact on your neshama to make you feel separate from God. Because God's spiritual, you're a physical being. You see that physical and spiritual can be separated, body separated from the soul, and therefore you feel separate. How do you correct that? You take the paraduma. Like we said, the mother comes and corrects what the child did. This ego seemed to you like a separate physical power, right? That was separate from God. But an intermediary, okay? But it's not true. Because everything is connected to God. Nothing is separate from God, right? And the Maharal says, that's why you bring the mother. Because if you look at what's in front of you, you may see what appears to be separate from the Ribbono Shel Olam. But if you trace everything back to its source, the source is God. Right? So if you don't look just at what's in front of you, but you trace it back to its source, everything emanates from God. So therefore, don't look at the ego as an entity to itself. Look where it came from. It came from a mother, that came from another mother, that came from another mother, all the way back to the original para that was created by God. So if you trace things back to their source, the source of everything is God. There's no separation. So the para aduma, right, represents the fact that if you reduce you trace everything back to its source, and you take the physical and you burn it and reduce it and show that it's something that's just it's not real. Right? You take the you put together with it a piece of cedar wood, which represents something really looks very gashmiistic, very big and impressive, and you reduce that to ashes. And you take the para, which looks like something, you know, to itself, like the power that the golden calf had. Power to itself, but it's not. It emanates from para, and you can reduce that to nothing. And you take a hyssop, which people feel that we're so lowly that why would God have anything to do with us? So you burn that too. And you take a colored wool, red colored wool, which represents sin. Sin is what separates between a person and God. All those separations you take and reduce them to nothing. And then you mix them with Mayim Chayim, which is spring water, which represents spirituality. And that is what is going to make you tar. It's going to change your philosophy. The coming in contact with the dead impacted on your neshama subconsciously, that you feel there's a separation between you and God. Coming in contact with the Afer of the Paraduma has a soul impact to show you just the opposite. There is no separation. It looks like that. If you only look at what's in front of you, trace it back to its source, reduce it all to ashes. There's nothing really there. It's all something that is kept going by the spiritual. If you take fire, which is a spiritual thing, it'll reduce all that physical thing to ashes. And then you take those ashes and you combine them to the epitome or the representation of spirituality, this water, and that will mimetire you. So basically what it is, it's not the physical ashes and water that make you tar, and it's not the physical corpse that brings you to tumah. It's a idea that this generates, right? It's a question that it generates in your neshama. One second. There's a big discussion amongst the shonim. Is it good to delve into philosophy and prove that there's a God and have all of the questions answered? What's it called? The questions on belief in God or whatever. Is it better to have emuna pshuta and not to delve into all these things? Mm-hmm. Bottom line, most say the following. If a person has questions and he needs answers, then he should delve into these and get the answers. But if a person has no questions, and then delving into these things is going to create the questions, then it's counterproductive. Right? If you don't have any questions, right, if it's not broken, don't fix it. If you don't have any questions, don't look for answers, because the answers will give you the questions. And the answers may not be as good as the questions then. Mm-hmm. If you have questions, then you need answers. Then go into it and find the answers. the Nela, a person who's tahar, he's pure, spiritually pure. He has no questions. His neshama was not impacted with this problem. Now you're going to introduce him to the paraduma and tell him an answer to a question he didn't have. No. The physical and spiritual can go together. Very nice. I didn't think they couldn't. Now you're telling me an answer to a question I didn't have. What does that do? Raise the question minimally. Makes your tummy. If you have the question because your neshama came in contact with a dead body, you have the question, then the answer will take away the question. Then you become tahar. So the same thing that can make one person tameh who was tahar can make a person who was tameh tahar. Because to one, it answers the question that his neshama got by coming in contact with the dead. To the other, it raises the question that his neshama didn't have because he didn't come in contact with the dead. So that's why the paraduma is metameh tahorim and metahir tahorim, and that's why it is a kapara for the cheta ego. And it has to do with death, because both of those things go together. And that's why the Mishkan was also a kapara for the cheta ego. The same idea. Okay. Any questions on that? I think it was somewhat clear. But it's a little bit clearer to me than when it was when I saw it. Yeah.
So ashes and sackcloth, is there any relation to that?
To what?
The ashes, more the high, put ashes and sackcloth on your
head.
Do the ashes there have any meaning with the ashes of the paraduma? Is there any connection?
Why we put ashes as a symbol of mourning? Maybe. Symbol of mourning, right, is that a person realizes that his connection to the world is not all that great. Things are bad, right? Look. Very, very dangerous for him, or sad, or suffering, or whatever it may be, that causes avelus, that causes a person to mourn. And one of the ways, I guess, of representing that is taking into consideration that this physical world, right, is not all that real, because you can reduce it all to ashes, too. So putting ashes, it says the ashes are the antithesis of tefillin. Tefillin represent the connection between you and God. They're the pair. The glory of a person is that his physical side and spiritual side can be tied together, and you can be tied to God in this world, physical and spiritual. When you feel separate from God, you're mourning. You feel that what's it called? That the physical world is oppressive to you. So one of the ways of getting out of that or representing that is don't take the physical world too seriously, because it all can be reduced to ashes. And that's the opposite of that. What makes the world real is its connection to God. That's the tefillin. That's the pe'er. That's the glory. The pe'er and the efer are the same letters. The antithesis of that is that if you really feel that you're separated from God and you're just physical, the physical world is really nothing, because if you take fire, you can reduce all of that to ashes. Maybe there is a connection. I don't know. Maybe that's a connection. Okay. Another thing. Shabbos. In this week's Sedra, Shabbos is referred to in the masculine. Kol ha'osa bo melacha mos yumas. In last week's Sedra, Shabbos was referred to as the feminine. Kol ha'osa bo melacha mechalaleha. Right? So why is Shabbos masculine feminine? There are other words that are masculine and feminine, but here, if you can explain it, there's a good reason to understand why Shabbos sometimes is masculine, and we reflect it in our davening. In Friday night, we say v'yanuchu v'ah, referring to the Shabbos as feminine. Shabbos morning, we say v'yanuchu v'oh, referring to Shabbos as the masculine. And Shabbos mincha, we say bam, connecting the masculine and feminine. Shamar v'zachar, which is also connected. Shamar is the more feminine aspect of Shabbos. Zachar, obviously, zachar is the masculine aspect of Shabbos. What are the two ideas? To make a long story short, right, try to put it in the time we have, plus to have room for one more thing. The basic idea is like this. There are two lessons of Shabbos. One is a very negative lesson. That's the Shomer lesson of Shabbos. And one's a very positive lesson. The negative lesson of Shabbos is you are not the boss here. You didn't create this world. You're not the creator. You don't create the framework. You are a created being who has to comply to the design of the creator, whether you like it or not. Not because he can zap you with a lightning bolt. That's not really the motivation to keep the Torah. There's a very more fundamental motivation, and that's the following. When you buy a car, you get an owner's manual. Tells you what gas to put in the gas tank and what oil to put in the crankcase and what kind of detergent to use on the upholstery, right? Now, on the surface, that doesn't seem to make any sense. You bought this car. You paid good money for it. It's yours. Why should the manufacturer have a right to tell you what to do with it? The answer is very simple. He manufactured the car and designed it. So you can do whatever you want with the car. You can put water in the gas tank, right? It's not going to go anywhere. Because the design of the designer was to run on a certain grade of gas. And it may even run on a different grade of gas, but you're burning out the motor. So God designed us. He designed us to eat certain things and not to eat other things, to wear certain things and not to wear, to think, to speak, everything. Right? So he gave us an owner's manual called the Torah. You don't have to listen to it, but you're going to burn out your motor. This is what you were designed to do. Right? And that's why the design could be for different models, a different design. Right, so Goyim have their mitzvahs, and Jews have theirs, and Kohanim have theirs, and women have theirs, and they're all different models of cars, and they run on different. If you're a what's it called, a diesel engine, you have a different kind of gas than if you're a gasoline engine. Right, so everybody has the design that they were designed to do, and this is the owner's manual that fits you. So Shabbos tells me you are not the boss over here, and how does it tell me that? Because if the boss says that the factory's closed and you can't be a creator, then one day a week it's off bounds. And that means that I accept by not answering the phone on Shabbos that it's not my phone. It's God's phone. And he can tell me not to use it. Because if it's mine, I can do whatever I want with it. But if it's not my world, I was created in the world. But I didn't create this world and I didn't design it. So I'm bound to the design of the designer. Keeping Shabbos shows that. It's a statement. I am not the boss over here. I have to live within the confines of the designer's design. On the other hand, Shabbos has another lesson. That within that design, you are very important because you're a partner with God in creation. He wants you to create the world to come. By what you do in this world, you create the world to come. So, on the one hand, Shabbos tells me you're really nobody. You're not the boss over here. And on the other hand, Shabbos tells me that within the framework that God created, you're very important. You're a partner with God in creation. So the Shomer aspect is the negative lesson. You're not the boss. The Zohar is, you may not be the boss, but in the boss's factory, you are very important, and you have the most important job to do to be a partner with the boss in creating the world to come, according to his framework, not your framework. So the two go together. Shabbos Zachar always implies the giver, and Nekeva is the receiver. Okay, it has nothing to do with men and women per se, because it applies to plumbing, to electricity, and to words that are words of giving and receiving, and it refers to a host of other things. It happens to apply to men and women also, in a certain way, even to the physical relationship between them. But in any case, the Shabbos has where the Shabbos is the giver, where the Shabbos is the receiver. The Shamru V'Nesu Shabbos and the Shmira part of Shabbos, we make the Shabbos, meaning the following. If I would ignore the Shabbos and not keep Shabbos, so the Shabbos would be meaningless. Because part of the Shomer aspect of Shabbos is that I make a statement that I didn't create this world. Proof, because God said one day a week, it's off limits to you. You can't be a creator. So if it's your world, you can do whatever you want. If it's my world, I'm telling you, you can't come into the factory on Shabbos. So in that respect, by me keeping Shabbos, I am making the Shabbos. I'm making it significant. If I ignore the Shabbos, then the Shabbos really is not significant at all. Its significance comes from my observing it. We make the Shabbos. So since we're making the Shabbos is receiving from us, Shabbos is feminine. On the other hand, where Shabbos tells me that you are a partner with God, God created the world in 6 days for the sake of Shabbos, and your working 6 days in this world creates that Shabbos of Olam Haba, the Shabbos intrinsically says that I'm somebody important. Whether I keep the Shabbos or not is irrelevant, because the Shabbos itself stands for the fact that God made me a partner with in creation. So in that respect, Shabbos gives me importance. Shabbos is the giver, I'm the receiver. In that respect, the Zohar, Shabbos is what's it called, the male, and I'm the female. I receive from the Shabbos, Shabbos gives to me. Since both of these aspects go together. In other words, the fact that I'm the negative aspect, you're not the boss, right? But in the framework that the boss made, you're very important, those two things go together. So for Zohar v'shomer b'dibur echad, that's why, what's it called, on Shabbos Mincha, we put them together. The two things go together, we say v'yanuchu v'am, in the plural. So that is the idea of Shabbos being male and female, two different aspects of Shabbos. Okay. One last thing, and then we'll... It says that the Mishkan was like a microcosm of the universe. Microcosm, it's a little redundant. But anyway, it was a microcosm. Okay, it was a small model of the universe. And not only physically also, it looked like a planetarium. When you walked into the Mishkan at night, so you saw the brass hooks in the top looked like a planetarium, looked like the stars. But it was more, every thing in the Mishkan corresponded to different things in the universe, and all the different universes, all the different worlds, the physical world, the spiritual world, or whatever. And it was built, that we once explained that the whole universe is in a model of a human being, or a human being is the model of the universe. The universe has hands, and the universe has a digestive system or whatever, conceptually. And it's physically in a human being, but conceptually it's in the whole universe. And the Mishkan contained all those conceptual things that are in the universe. And therefore, the way the Mishkan was built was the way the universe was built. How did God make this world? Bereishis Bara Elokim. God originally intended to make the world with the Midas HaDin, with justice, pure justice. And he then added Rachamim, mercy. So how was the Mishkan made? By two people. Who were they? Bezalel, from the tribe of Yehuda. Yehuda is Yudke Vavke, Rachamim. Yehuda has God's four-letter name in his name. And Aliyav came from which tribe? Dan, which is Din. So you have Din and Rachamim creating the Mishkan. Also, the way the world was made, it says that the world expanded. Very interesting, very similar to what science says. The world God created, and it continued expanding until God said, stop expanding. Shaddai. Sha'omar lo'olam odai. And the Kliyoker says, why was it created like that? Why couldn't God just create it the way it was? Why didn't they expand and then stop it from expanding? Because, again, we are a small universe, every human being. And just like in the major universe, if you don't stop it, it can expand to places that it shouldn't be. The small human being should learn from that, that if you don't say stop enough, you can expand into places you shouldn't be either. So you have to sometimes say stop enough. That's the Yetzer HaTov controlling the Yetzer Hara. The Mishkan also was made like that. It says in this week's Sedra that when they donated to the Mishkan, it was they were giving so much that Moshe had to say enough, stop. Why? Because it had a pattern itself after the creation of the world. So many, many things that were in the Mishkan that were parallel to the creation of the world, and therefore, what's it called? It says by the end of the Mishkan, "Vateichel kolo avedos avoda," similar to "Vayichulu Hashemayim v'aretz." There's so many parallels between creation and the building of the Mishkan, because the building of the Mishkan was our conception of creation, which explains one last thing, why the melachas that you're not allowed to do on Shabbos are the 39 melachas that went into building the Mishkan. Because what are we commemorating on Shabbos? That God stopped creating the world. What is our conception of creation? The 39 melachas that went into building the Mishkan. That's our creation of a mini world. So we stop doing those melachas that went into building the world, and that represents the fact that we stop creating, just like God stopped creating the big world on Shabbos.
But the world is ever expanding. I mean, after that, the universe continues to expand.
Yeah, okay, but even that, yeah, that's, again, that's why I said it's not exactly the same thing. Because according to us, the Rebbeinu Shlom put, but the truth is, he put limits on that expansion. Because it's expanding, but there's a limit to how much it can expand, or how fast it can expand, or whatever. So the same thing over here. People are also expanding constantly, but they have to know what the limits to that expansion are.